Sitting with Warrior by Carl Hitchens. Dedicated to all warriors, large and small, from all walks of life, of all times and places. This is a dream, all that is required of me in this moment. Is sustained, unaltered awareness. This is the essence of sight, where light and shadow become one. Didn't know for a long, long time the depth of my wounded mind and spirit. Thought I was invincible. Marched through Washington back in the day, me and the other vets, cutting images from the jungles of Nam, pasting their ragged and bloody pictorial onto the album of pomp and circumstance. Dream stepping down Pennsylvania Avenue onto the covers of magazines and newspapers. Front pages. The healing passed me over. My sickness incurable to group inoculations of honoring and celebration. After thoughts politically won by survivors who refused to die out of the American consciousness. Chapter 1, Far from Eden. The campfire was glowing in the distance, its golden reddish color leaping out into the night from far back in the forest. I moved toward the blaze slowly, cautiously, stealthily weaving my way through the dark. Though I was wary of who and what I might find, curiosity drove me on like an animal toward my fate. Cloaking myself in silence, I reached a tangle of bushes a short distance from the firelight. There I knelt and looked intently. Sitting cross-legged on the other side of the burning logs was a Native American warrior, his copper complexion showing in the wavering light. He wore face paint. His body was covered in buckskin from mantle, breechcloth, and leggings to the moccasins on his feet. Around his forehead was a headband with a single eagle feather in it, except for the scalp lock on top. His head was shaven. Beside him were a bow, a quiver full of arrows, and a heavy wooden war club. He was smoking tobacco in a wooden pipe, staring into the flames. There was something about him that felt old and familiar. From my hiding place, I studied him, intrigued at how he blended seamlessly into his environment. He certainly wasn't a faint outline, but his presence melded perfectly into the forest around him. Like a tree swaying in the wind, or the pouring down of rain. He was a weave in nature's intricate fabric. I watched the way he puffed his pipe, drew the smoke in as if pulling the world around him inside, holding it, and then blowing it back on the curls of smolder rising from his lips. It was as if he was breathing in and out his own existence. Every so often, he would glance around, not looking with his eyes exactly, but from behind them in some inscrutable way. I had the inexplicable feeling that I knew him. "Well, are you going to stay there all night, in the cold? Or are you going to join me at the fire here, and let me see who's looking at me?" I knew I had been made. Still, I glanced around, hoping someone else would step forward. "Well," I slowly stood up and walked around the twisting vegetation toward him, eyeing carefully his weapons and his hands and their distance from me. As I approached the warrior, he transferred the smoke pipe from the hand that held it to the one resting on his knee. He gazed at me and then pointed with his eyes to where his free hand patted the ground with an invitation to sit. I calculated his reach and parked myself just beyond it, pulling my legs up under me in his fashion. He smiled to himself, evidently amused at my wariness. I noticed close up that the paint markings on his face were zigzag drawings of lightning, and that his headband was beaded, perhaps with colored seeds. "The light of my fire has always burned," he stated. "Yet it is just now that you have found your way to me." "Who am I? That is your question, is it not? I can hear it loud and clear. As clear and deafening as those rockets blasting into the compound that day in April 1968. Images of the attack surfaced immediately in my mind. "Incoming! Incoming!" bellowed through the hooch like the recoil of a thunderous boom, which had bolted from the sky in an ominous whistle. The shouting was the salt-seasoned reflexes kicking in with the fluid motility of controlled terror. Bodies hurled themselves off couches. Feet hit the deck running, pounding across the wooden floor out into the night toward the bunker. This was my first rocket attack, my first confrontation with the fear demons dogging me since first pulling orders for WestPac, that is, Western Pacific operations. In the prevailing winds of the day, this meant one thing: Vietnam. Raw instinct covered my lack of experience and put me in mental sync with the others. I jackknifed off my rack and raced behind them, forcing out an "incoming" as I went by the ranking NCO. This shout was more a grounding for my fear than it was a warning to anyone. "Good man," said the corporal, duty-bound as the last man out, waving an urgent hand onto my shoulder and guiding me out the door. The bunker was low to the ground, with a cramped entrance to crawl through. It was dark, sandy, and close inside. The air was a thick, dusty mixture of earth scent and perspiration, trapped in a palpable atmosphere of constrained fear. A direct hit by common reckoning would turn this shelter into a tomb. "Everybody in?" the corporal asked. Yeas and ahas answered back in the affirmative. All right, sound off when I call your name. Down his mental list he went, each name eliciting a here or here, corporal. All right, we'll see how long this one lasts. No one out till the all clear sounds. I know you guys really want to be out there, right? Some chuckled nervously. Others replied with silence. Life and death humor hit too close to home to tease out much laughter, especially when the punchline could be you in a body bag. Some of the men lit up cigarettes, the flickering flames of matches and lighters creating wavering shadows in the dark chamber. One man extended a smoke to me. I took it, puffed it into a glow from his cigarette, and pulled the flame fumes into my lungs. The 122s were slamming the ground all around the sandbagged fortification, the close ones kicking up the red beach sand on the outside walls like death spray trying to probe its way into our minds. A loud, metallic scrunch moaned a direct hit a short distance away. Huddled in the dark with the other Marines, I felt the distance between birth and death collapse into one eternal moment, where the flame of life fought against the winds of fate. It was nothing in thought or feeling that possessed me, but rather an infusion of some innate awareness that pushed through the mind and the senses, like the replay of an ancient memory. A narrow vertical line of light appeared on the dark screen of my mind, burst into light particles, and then was gone. I knew this image was of the moment of death, that flashing of life into oblivion, and that my own dying one day was as certain as my need for air. Youthful illusions faded that night into a sobering maturity. The all-clear siren sounded, and we spilled out of the bunker. It was good to breathe the air outside, even though it stunk with the sulfurous scent of explosives. The first faint light of dawn was just breaking as we stood gawking at the mess hall 100 yards away. A big portion of the roof was collapsed, and a gaping tear was ripped into one long wall. We studied the wreckage as if it were a piece of art, engrossed in its twisted, misshapen appearance in the same uncanny way that one falls spellbound to nature's cataclysms. As with the atomic mushroom cloud, some eerie, grotesque beauty had unwrapped itself from the raw destruction and pinned our eyes to its magnetic power. Something shifted in me during those mesmerizing moments. I began to walk a different path through life. The unconscious sense of immortality that attaches itself to youth left me. In its place, under the cold stare of truth, the grasping of life's impermanence took root. It was clear that mortality walked every step with me. In the face of such destructive forces, unleashed with such harmful intent, so utterly close in that place and time, I grasped the delicate stitching that held my life in one piece. Steeped in that realization, I set myself to the task of survival, not so much by a conscious directing of the will, as by an unconscious drive for self-preservation, tuning my awareness around an axis of acute instinct and reflexes, where circumstances fell within my control, where my own actions mattered. I would act, think, and feel my way through the continuance of my earthly existence. Judging from the puzzled look on your face, you're wondering how I knew what happened that day, how I reached into your memories and pulled out that event for you to see. I nodded. You are curious about me, who I am, and why I seem so familiar to you. Again, I nodded. I am Warrior, and your coming here is no accident. You sought me out. You looked high and low, so to speak. I didn't know how to reply. When you left Vietnam for the world, for home, you left that exotic place you had come to know, come to expect certain things of, and re-entered one whose reality had shifted from your mind's memory to something else entirely. It was not the home of your past. As the home of your future, it was an ungainly thing to contemplate. On the surface of your five senses, there were many things still familiar in the ebb and flow of sights and sounds. But in your subjective inner reality, this was a world apart from what you had known. More directly opposed, though, to your peace and tranquility were those sensory factors tying you inexorably to the distant land you had departed. In some bizarre way, Vietnam had come along as a permanent part of your inner landscape. So much so that a car's backfire was now a booby trap going off. Clackers, poppers, click-clacks, or identical toys by any other name were AKs popping death. An overhead helicopter was either a gunship giving air support or a medevac coming for the dead and wounded. There was an edge to everything. Nam, as you refer to it, was a tropical country of mystery and mysterious people, of rice paddies, monsoon rains, and death by combat. It was a contradiction of lushness and devastation, of beauty and grotesqueness. You looked for yourself within its mental and physical borders, in its chaotic paradox of constant change and monotony. There, in its wild stampeding of events, you lost yourself and then found yourself, only to lose yourself again on returning home. And you have been in the process of discovering who and what you are for the last 39 years. Coming to Vietnam was at once exhilarating and terrifying. Getting off the Continental Airlines plane at the airbase in Da Nang was the culmination of my private ambition to face the crucible of mortal danger. Like my heroes in American iconic culture, I hoped in the taking on of such peril that I would find myself. I had seen inklings of that genuine self in the male heroes of literature, stage, and film, the rugged individualists who trod their own path, followed their own truth, and dwelled outside the crowd and crowd hysteria. Men who took the road less traveled, but arrived inexorably time and again at the head of waters of the masses, where fate forced them to sacrifice personal safety in defense of others. It mattered not whether these men rode the old West alone or stormed upon the shore of Iwo Jima with a crowd of Marine infantry. They were self-contained, pillars of strength and indomitable will. They led by example and their composure under fire. In the midst of chaos and change, they instilled a sense of hope. They kept their own counsel, fought their own demons, and prevailed over madness and evil. They were men carved out of their own innate natures, unspoiled by outside intrusion. Through the gravest of circumstances, the cream of their most authentic self rose to the top. My unearthing would then seem to lie in a similar path. I had searched for my elusive self in other areas of American culture, but I was not there in the halls of higher education. I could not hear my song in the music culture that joined me to my peers. I was not to be found in the tumult of political activism, the moral war over the war fought out on the plains of ideation. Ideas reveal what you think or what others think carried inside of you, not necessarily who you are, what you're made of. Shane, hero of the cowboy western of the same name, felt like more than an idea. Sergeant John Stryker, cinematic protagonist in the sands of Iwo Jima, felt like more than an idea. Sergeant Saunders of television's Combat felt like more than an idea. A quintessential male role model seemed to emerge from these characters who were not defined by their environment, but revealed by it. By the time I signed my Marine Corps enlistment papers in 1967, my path to the jungles of Nam had been cast indelibly upon my future. I don't remember a lot of visual detail about the flight from California to Vietnam. There was a short stopover in Hawaii for refueling, my first and only trip to our 50th state. This was my maiden voyage outside the United States. Up to that point, not even the soils of Canada and Mexico had dusted my shoes. I do remember the crew, from the pilot on down, being extremely friendly and cordial. I remember the stress and my outer excitement mixed together with introspection. Going to war strips you down to the basics. Would I survive? But not just survive. Would I do so without missing body parts or mobility? Would I acquit myself well? Would I, more of an impression than thought, regret signing my life over to the Corps? And then there was that image of my mother crying as we unhugged at the doorway of her apartment in Washington, D.C., our hometown where we both had grown up. It was a soft, controlled crying, but nevertheless, heart-wrenching. Mom was not given to overt shows of emotion, so this was significant. The end of the flight was memorable, too, by my recollection. After the plane's captain announced we were making our approach for landing, he wasted no time getting us on the ground. A turn and a bank, followed by a rapid descent, and we were touching down. Evasive maneuvers to thwart any ground-to-air attack from the enemy? It sure felt like it, and it sure added to my realization that I was not coming to a tropical vacation spot. No, this was going to be hazardous duty. I was sure hoping that Shane, Stryker, and Saunders had made the trip with me, because I was going to need them badly. Getting out of the plane and getting our boots on the ground wasn't much solace either. As we passed the formations of Marines waiting to board their Freedom Bird out of Vietnam, marching past their gauntlet of hoots, catcalls, and derisive shouts of, "Hey, Boots, welcome to Nam," we started to get the picture. Something about their hyper-euphoria, their downright delirium at leaving that place, gave us a clue to just how long 13 months of blood and guts reality might feel. Hurry up and wait. The old military golden rule came next. Our herd of new warm bodies was directed into a huge hangar and divided into queues to receive our orders. These would be the most important orders I had received up to then in my brief Marine career. They would designate the unit I would be sent to. Its name would call me not only to duty, but also to my future self waiting in the wings of destiny. All duty was not the same in Nam, but with an assigned military occupational specialty of 0311 riflemen, it wasn't much of a leap to see a rifle company somewhere in my future. There in that building, where the fickle finger of fate was as mercurial as flying shrapnel, I bid goodbye to many Marine friends, some I had known from the first days of boot camp at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot at Parris Island, South Carolina, some from ITR, Infantry Training Regiment, at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and others, more recently, from Camp Pendleton's jungle training at San Diego, California. Most I would not see again, so dispersed were we into different areas of the country, into different spokes of the Corps' strategic organization. Many would not return home. Our 20-minute layover in Hawaii might have been a touch of paradise, but we were far from Eden now.